Radio St. Pete presents Typewriter Talks with Maureen McDowell, founder and executive director of Keep St. Pete Lit.
Hello, welcome to Typewriter Talks. This podcast features interviews with writers, poets, and other bookish folks. My name is Maureen McDowell, and I am the founder and executive director of Keep St. Pete Lit, which is a literary arts organization based in St. Petersburg, Florida. On Typewriter Talks, we discuss all kinds of writerly topics, hoping to show you that there is not one right way to be a writer. Today, we are happy to welcome Jarrett Keene. Jarrett earned his PhD in creative writing at Florida State University. A beloved and highly sought after professor, Dr. Keene is an assistant professor in the Department of English at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, where he teaches American literature and the graphic novel. He has written a travel guide, a rock band biography, poetry collections, and edited short fiction anthologies, including Las Vegas Noir and Dead Neon, Tales of Near Future Las Vegas. His newest book, Hammer of the Dogs, is a YA dystopian thriller set in the wasteland of post-apocalyptic Las Vegas. Welcome, Jarrett.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being here all the way in Las Vegas. You're in Las Vegas now, correct?
Correct. But as you might know, I'm from Tampa, Florida. I spent a lot of time in St. Petersburg there, checking out shows at Janus Landing, hanging out in the Dali Museum, et cetera.
Yes. So I also grew up here and I went to many of shows at Janus Landing. Now it's called Janus Live.
Right. But
it was the glory days in the 90s of the music scene here, seeing bands for $15, $10. And
I loved it. Concrete Blonde, Iggy Pop.
Yeah. My poor child has to pay like hundreds of dollars now to see his favorite bands. We lived in the glory days.
It's a bit tragic today, but at least we experienced it and have the wonderful memories of that time, that place. And it's still a wonderful area to live.
Yes, it just got voted as one of the happiest places to live on Outside Magazine, from Outside Magazine.
Right.
That's crazy, even though we have hurricanes that just pass by us.
Oh, you know, it keeps you on your toes. It keeps you awake.
So tell us what you're working on right now.
I just released my dystopian adventure novel, Hammer of the Dogs, and it's something that I've been working on for a few years. It all began when I had, I guess you might say, a different career. I was working as a corporate communicator for the hotel casinos here on the Las Vegas Strip. And with my little employee badge, I could sneak around all over these properties, Luxor, Mandalay Bay, MGM Grand, Bellagio, and see back of house, see how things worked, the worlds within worlds, the, the Luxor Skybeam, how that functioned and operated and was maintained. I snuck backstage to see the Mandalay Bay wave machine there on the beach, the ersatz, coastal environment that they created there with, you know, the sand and the water. And I don't know, I just began to think about what this environment might look like should there be a kind of, well, collapse. And then adding to everything, there was the convention business that, you know, you might be aware that Las Vegas is a huge destination for industry conventions.
Yeah.
One of those conventions is the Drone Tech Convention. And so every year it seemed there'd be a gathering of companies whose mission is to advance drone technology, drone surveillance, drone weaponry. And so I'd sneak in, I'd crash these gatherings, and I was awestruck and a little frightened by what they were bringing to the convention floor. To see that confluence, to see the connection between the tech sector, military industrial complex, law enforcement, higher education, foreign governments, to see them all together engaged in this business of building smarter, smaller, faster, more lethal drones, added to my you might say, unusual understanding of Las Vegas and the surrounding desert. So I decided to come up with an adventure story, and it all began with the opening scene of my novel, which I hope I'll have a chance to read to you. It's that's where I started, and I just dreamed the rest straight through, much like we dreamed our way through those 80s sci-fi action apocalypse movies you and I enjoyed as kids.
Yeah, and so why did you choose to do it as a YA novel?
Well, I'm using that term maybe a little loosely. I always loved Jack London,
Yeah.
White Fang, etc., Call of the Wild, and I loved Stephen Crane, the Red Badge of Courage, and I loved Huckleberry Finn and all those novels that feature young men and women. I don't know if you read The Yearling
Yes.
by Marjorie Rawlings. Yeah, it's incredible little story, little novel, and
Into her house here. There used to be a writing conference. I think it was in the early 90s called Writing, or maybe the mid 90s. I'm not sure. Called Writing the Region.
yes, I
And
remember it.
yeah, in Gainesville. And they part of the writing conference was a trip out to her house. And that was just so cool. Good old Florida. Love Florida.
Yes, so I'm making a note here that you and I need to revive that conference. But
Yes, that was a great conference.
in any case, yeah, growing up in Florida, reading these adventure novels, they always stuck with me. And Fahrenheit 451, you could argue that that's a line. I mean, I'm using the term loosely, but it's just that kind of adventure fiction that you never grow out of. And so that's sort of my revised definition or understanding of young adult literature. I don't really see Hammer of the Dogs as having much to do with the YA category genre as it currently stands. I'm shooting for something, maybe aiming for something a little grander, little more timeless.
Well, and you also seem to, based on your writing portfolio, if that's the term, you're kind of all over the board in what interests you as a writer.
Yes.
You don't you're not really drawn to just one genre, which is awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it might be my ADHD, or it just might be that I love moving from, category to category. I think I was lucky in the sense that I didn't get an academic job immediately after graduate school. I had to work for many years as a entertainment journalist. And then, as I mentioned, I became a corporate communicator, like a writer of internal propaganda for the casino companies. And then finally, I managed to snare a teaching job, which transitioned into a tenure position. I was lucky, I think, because it taught me all the different uses of writing, and it's this application, this hands-on approach to making writing work for you as a career that I bring to my students. And I think they appreciate it because I do notice that they seek out and achieve validation through writing, through publication, through this may sound wild, getting paid for their work.
What a concept.
Maureen, as you know, being in the literary field, the payments come few and far between.
Yeah, I have a reading tonight and I'm driving all the way to Tampa. And I'm just like,
Yeah.
and it's like if you just think about it, it's just for shits and giggles in some ways, because there's no payment to show up and read your work for 10 minutes and drive all the way over the bridge, which isn't that far. But if you
No,
live
it's
in,
still $40 in gas. I mean,
yeah, if you live in St. Pete, Tampa is a whole other galaxy, far, far away.
yes. Well, I understand more than anyone how desperate it can be trying to get paid for being your work as a writer. And one of the biggest drawbacks to being a freelancer, at least in the mid-2000s, early 2010s was simply collecting the money that you're owed. I was working as a stringer for People Magazine, Us Weekly. These magazines you see in the grocery store still today, at the pharmacy or whatever, and it would take me forever to get paid. I'd have to use their portal. I'd have to upload my documents, my documentation, and my receipts and all the stuff. And it took months to get work for to get paid for the work done that I did for high profile, so-called elite publications. So it's just not easy getting paid. It's not easy to, have these companies pay you promptly on time and or at least timely enough so that you can pay your rent.
But then we're still writers, aren't we?
Yes.
We are not deterred. We still do it. And
Yes.
you're teaching students to write. So there is still that optimism and the excitement that keeps you going.
Oh yes. I mean, before I got on this call with you, I was finishing up a recommendation letter for a student who's applying for a PBS job here in town, and I know that student will secure the job because they interview great. They've got a great CV, and they've got some great rec letters, including one that I've written them. So,
So tell us what a typical day looks like for you as a writer.
well, as a writer, it's very important for me to clear my head and sort of get into the space that I need to be in. And for me, that involves going to the gym or doing like some circuit training or going outside for a hike. I find that if I embrace nature, which is a bit hard to come by here in the Vegas Valley, it's very beige, very dusty, very artificial. I tend to have to go to the edges of the valley, Mount Charleston, Red Rock National Park, Valley of Fire. Places like that to kind of clear my head and get into that proper space, like as I was saying. And then I might sit down for a few hours and hopefully get a at least 1,000, 2,000, if I'm lucky, 3,000 words on the page, on the Word document. And from there, it's just revising and building. I'm not someone who can write a book the whole way through. I have to revise as I go along, especially if where I've ended it feels a little wonky or strange. I want it to settle. And so to a degree it becomes a little bit like sculpture more than
Oh, I love that. I love that.
writing all the way straight through. I tend to kind of to polish and pamper my chapters. At least that was the case with this novel, and I've certainly done the same for nonfiction. And I just, move my way through the book and I try to stay in a dream state, which is, as becomes increasingly more difficult with the more technology that burbles and beeps around us.
Yeah.
You try to turn off social media. You don't want any of those notifications or anything like that, because they can distract me. And then I just push until I can get to a place where I have something to present to, what you might call a reader or someone who's willing to edit, or give me some ideas. And that's really just the process for me. I can't really sit on a book and work on it for more than a few months. I have to put it aside, pick up something else, maybe an article or a poem or a short story or
Yeah, I like to move between different things too, depending on my mood.
Yes.
Nice to have multiple, like I've got poetry and I've got essays, and then I write an article for a magazine, and it's nice to move between those depending on what headspace I'm in. Are you led by the characters, or are you led by the plot, or both?
I'm led by, I don't know what to call them, scenes, set pieces, like moments. I am, for better or worse, shaped by those dark movie theater screenings in the 80s of films like Goonies, Gremlins, Empire Strikes Back,
Worse.
Conan the Barbarian. And I loved all the obscure movies that I saw, you know, like Sheena, Supergirl, the ones that didn't do so well at the box office. Howard the Duck, Legend of Billie Jean, you know, these movies
I love Legend of the Billy
that.
Jean. I love that movie. God, that was such a cool movie.
Well, that movie was very big in Tampa in the 80s, in the, you know, during that time.
Yeah,
Not
my
to
kid is totally into movies. He's 17 and he has a hard time because a lot of his friends were raised, with social media and cell phones, and they don't have the attention span to sit through a movie. And I was very like no cell phone until you're in ninth grade, and like you can watch DVDs, like very like kind be outside, do art. And he struggles with that because he wants to share these movies with all his friends. He's a huge movie buff, but they just don't have the attention span, a lot of them. So he's always got some he's there's a big Halloween marathon coming up of he at Tampa Theater, and he's just so excited. It's really cool to see.
You mean the slasher franchise?
Yeah, well, no, like they're showing Saw, and they're
Oh,
showing a
good.
bunch of different, and he actually is just created out of foam the headgear of the movie Saw that he's wearing. It's just like,
Wonderful.
I know, I'm looking at this child and I'm like, you're such a gift. You're so like not the
Yeah.
main reality. So I totally, and we're total movie buffs. Like we actually gauge people if they like Interstellar or not. We're like, if you don't like
Right.
Interstellar, they're not our people. Like we just
Right.
can't. It's
Yes.
funny. But do you plot out your stories, or you just really go with the flow with them?
I really dream them out. I mean, I have four or five what you might call connected scenes, and then I'll try to find a way to connect those to, you know, three, four, or five other, you know, momentous, fantastic scenes. I really constructed Hammer of the Dogs, and I'm hoping I'll do it again with the you know, the sequel to this book. But I really constructed it like you know, an 80s sci-fi fantasy film like Labyrinth or Legend, where every, you know, scene cut leads you to another wondrous yet frightening you know, moment. And I don't know any other way at this point. You know, I was doing it already with my fiction, trying to you know, cut right to the, what you might say, the no filler, all killer scenes. And I found myself really enjoying that. So I decided to stretch out and do it with a longer work with this novel. And it's a lot of fun to, you know, write something fun.
Yeah. So how has your writing process changed over the years?
Well, when I completed my PhD in creative writing, I was an anxious mess. You know, I believed in fierce revision. I believed in fierce literary standards. I believed, you know, I was really kind of uncompromising and snobby, and it wasn't making me happy. So I moved beyond that, well beyond that. I still love everything I wrote in my 20s. I think in moments I was better in my 20s than I am now, to, you know, in certain aspects. But because I was so principled, uncompromising, and so literary. But now, you know, I just realized that I was sort of writing the same stuff that everyone else was writing, and I wasn't, you know, I wasn't confident that what I had to say was any more distinctive than what was being published in the literary magazines, or the or, you know, the New Yorker, the Atlantic, or something like that. So I decided to really please myself and make myself happy and write with the kind of, this is the term that I've been using lately, you know, bright darkness that I enjoyed in so many of these 80s movies that I loved. And I don't want to leave out the animated features that I grew up loving, like Secret of Nim.
Oh my God, I am her.
Yeah, the
This is
last
creepy. I love that movie.
you
Yeah.
know, the last unicorn,
Yes.
Who Framed Roger Rabbit, things like that. You know, they really moved me. And I wanted to write in that way that's unforgettable. I think I saw Secret of NIMH once as a child, and I at the movie theater, and I never I memorized every part of it just from that one viewing. I was so, I like laser focused on it, and I didn't watch it again for many years, maybe until I was in graduate school, and I realized, hey, this is just terrific storytelling, whether it's for kids or whoever. And I want to write like that. I want to write that kind of story that when you read it, you just don't forget it, and it just stays with you. And that's what I set out to do with this book, Hammer of the Dogs.
So, what would you tell your younger writer self?
Oh man, lighten up. Don't be so serious. Don't write negative endings all the time. Vary your endings. I was trying to be so serious and so, I don't know. Just be less miserable, and it's okay to write a happy ending, and it's okay to love your characters and not destroy them.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It's just too much of that. And I feel like today, when I pick up a science fiction, I don't even like science fiction, honestly. I mean, science fiction novels, I read very few of them, because they seem to always end on a downer. And I don't want to end on a down. I want people to read a story of mine or a book of mine, and at the end, pump their fist a little bit in the air, go, yes, they did it.
Yeah, use the force.
Yes.
It's very ingrained in us that I'm going to be 49 this year. I'm not sure how old you are, but it's very ingrained in us that kind of optimism to, destroy the Death Star.
Yeah.
Like the Jedi's, like it's in us to the Generation X of just like we can do this. We can survive anything.
You see it in like Hunger Games to a degree, but it's in the on the literary side of on in the book end of it that I feel like things are more like, Handmaid's Tale, like there's a lot of torture and just.
Oh, I had to stop watching it, the series. I couldn't. I'm like, life is hard enough. I can't bring this into my. I just
No,
can't.
and Game of Thrones really
That too. I
finished that too.
literally. I was binge. I'm sorry. I'm getting so excited. I was binge watching it, and I had to stop because I kept thinking someone was going to come around every corner with a sword and kill me. Like it
Yeah.
was too much. It was just too much.
Well, it was the mutilation, the torture, and the other horrible things that
Oh.
really grossed me out. I couldn't I'm just not I'm just I'm built differently. I need a little bit of brightness to the dark to counteract the darkness. I can't have it, depressing all the way through. It just I'm done. I just can't. Sorry.
What are you noticing? How long have you been teaching?
Let's see. I started teaching part-time in 2001 sporadically, but then I started teaching full-time in, let's see, 2010.
What
So
are you noticing about students over those years? Because that's about 22 years. How have they changed?
well, you've touched on it already. I mean, they're cinematically, I don't want to say illiterate, but they just don't care about the things that year after year it seems the students have less interest in, what you might call the monoculture or, mainstream popular culture. They're very much into video games, anime, manga today, and they're not at all interested in anything that they've encountered in high school or through their parents. I don't think they've absorbed any of it, which is sort of exciting because it challenges me to catch up and engage with these art forms that I knew a little bit about as a Gen Xer, but they've really embraced things like webtoons and what you might call science fiction fantasy manga or
Yeah,
Gen.
my child watches people play video games.
Yes,
Like
yes.
it's a thing.
It's like on YouTube they'll watch
Yeah.
and I mean it's interesting to a degree. Like I sit with my sons and watch them watch videos of people playing video games just because Yeah, it's my opportunity to spend time with them. I got to follow them to a degree. But
They want to be, these students want to be writers still, though.
it's very weird. Yeah, it's very strange. They want to be writers, but they want to write things that I'm to a large degree ignorant of, and I'm trying to it's hard. I work harder now to bridge that chasm, to kind of meet them halfway. And I didn't have to do that, maybe 10 years ago. It's really accelerated in the last decade.
So are you hopeful?
Oh, very much. I mean, my students are terrific. And what I'm most hopeful about is that, they hide it away, but they're writing their little fan fiction, doing their little comics, their cosplay, their video game sketches and mock-ups and ideas, and they're doing their little YouTube channels and
Yeah.
podcasts, and so they're working. It's just, to a degree, I as a, and probably you as a Gen Xer, we hid away our secret passions, like Interview with a Vampire or Neuromancer.
Yeah. Well, we did that, the alter anything kind of alternative that wasn't like Coca-Cola t-shirts, like scrunchies, just didn't fit into you were different. You were, a weirdo or whatever term you want to use. And it was definitely counterculture. We did not have our Hot Topic. And so, but now that's it's more mainstream to be all those things. It's very
I've seen that as well. Yeah, I've seen that as well.
Pretty, but it is cool because my kid like goes to Comic-Con festivals and sells his art, and he's like 17 and does fan art, and people love it, and dresses up like Edward Scissorhands in a handmade costume, and it's just like so
Yes.
cool to see all these kind of different things that they're touching on, these kids, and
Yes.
at least my kid, and so it's it makes me hopeful too as well. So one more question, and then let's hear some of your work. What would be like your elevator pitch or like your lightning strike advice for other writers?
Well, it would be to write everything and anything you can and not to be snobby about, the possibility of writing for a magazine that covers something you're not familiar with. And I think students should automatically just head right to the student newspaper on their campus and start there. And you'll learn a lot about the production process, layout, design, journalistic standards. And the other thing I would encourage is you don't really need to do a writing program or this is not much of a lightning strike, but you don't need a writing program. You don't need a journalism degree. You can get to work right away. I think that's very valuable, maybe even more valuable than the degrees themselves.
Yeah, it's funny. My friend Mark Haber and we went to USF together and got an English degree, both of us. That's how I met him. And he was like, when we were growing up, Maureen, like, MFAs weren't a thing,
Yes.
and I was like, you're right. 'Cause it's like writers that are about a decade younger than me. I have several friends that are that age and they all have MFAs. And I was like, and every September or like August, I'll entertain the idea, but I'm like, I don't want to get $40,000 in debt for poetry, like, so it's funny, like it's a generational thing, kind of the whole MFAs, but I'm very curious to see if that kind of like kids don't necessarily want to go to college or move on to those spaces. They want to be more creative or trades. There's a rise in trades or being self-taught. So it's really interesting how that pendulum swings.
I mean,
So
I'm a professor. I want students to enroll in the MFA program here at the university. But if they do that, I think they should also understand that there is a professional, technical, commercial side to writing that they need to understand and engage with. That to me is more important than the degree itself. The degree is really just about, the workshop process, which is wonderful or can be wonderful, but there's also just the hard work and determination and doing what you need to do in order to get a paycheck, as small as it may be. It's something, and it validates you and makes you a professional.
I love that. That's Wonderful advice. It's wonderful advice. So let's hear some of your work.
You bet. I'll just read the opening so you'll get an idea of what Hammer of the Dogs offers readers, which is hopefully a lot of fun and a lot of danger and a lot of imagination. This is chapter one. Lash used a rock to smash the window of a vacant tract home. Before climbing in, she looked to see if the micro drone had followed. It careened from the front of the house, the pilot overcorrecting, the machine glancing off the brick facade. It was a nasty homebrew with a thermal imaging camera and what looked like an SRS-A2, the world's smallest sniper rifle. The four brushless motors had no gears, making it a quiet, efficient, nearly inescapable killer. She knew the hushed rotor wash would be imperceptible, even inches from her face. But Lash didn't hear drones. She intuited them. Drones changed the atmosphere around her. She was drawn to them, repulsed by them. For the briefest moment, her adversary had her mesmerized. Then the bucket of bits and chips steadied itself to draw a deadly bead. She jumped through the window. A shard of glass sliced her forearm. A bullet ripped through the window inches from her face. She yelped, fell backward onto a floor of broken dishes and garbage, then scampered out of the kitchen and got up to sprint for the door. In the tiled living room, she slipped on something greasy and landed on her tailbone, shockwaves of pain racking her spine. She got up and ran again. Still, she felt her stalker ghosting the air, growing closer. She was outside now. The longer she avoided death, the sooner the drone would exhaust its power supply and have to return to base station or risk crashing. But she had no idea where the station might be. The pilot, Richter, could be anywhere, orchestrating her demise with a suitcase downlink powered by an old car battery. He could be across the street right now, ready to blow her brains out with an AK, SKS, or even an old Remington. She took the chance. Lungs burning, legs throbbing, she made for the narrow space between two houses. She hoped to find a skateboard or kick scooter, anything to get her downhill fast and out of the suburban maze. She'd been searching for paint thinner. She was building a flamethrower and needed fuel that stayed liquid as it burned. She'd fantasized all year about incinerating Richter's cruel and handsome face. Gunfire cracked, shattering a garden gnome. She bounded a wooden backyard fence and spotted shears beside a drained swimming pool. She grabbed the landscaping tool just as the micro drone whirred up behind her. Swinging the shears, she pinched the machine by its landing skid, using its momentum to bounce it once, twice off the sliding glass door. The drone sputtered free, bobbing like a storm-tossed fishing cork, and fired. A giant spiderweb fracture erupted behind Lash. With her black Bedford lace-up combat boots, she kicked her way in and headed for the garage. She whimpered a prayer to St. Joseph of Cupertino, patron of pilots, for help against her assailant. But Richter was relentless. Nothing could save her now. If only she had a GPS jammer, something to spoof the drone into autopilot mode. All she had were fields of dead grass, dust, and abandoned homes. The overhead garage door was locked. She ducked into the laundry room and, noticing a can of lighter fluid, smiled with pyromaniacal intent. She opened a refrigerator, got in and closed the door, fumbling in her cargo shorts for the Zippo. She listened for the drone, sensed it nearby. It was searching for a heat signal. She would give it one. She swung open the fridge door. It clipped one of the drone's rotors, which sent it spinning out into the hallway. As it thrashed, fighting to achieve liftoff, she drenched it with lighter fluid, then flicked her Zippo, tossed it, and squirted more fluid onto the flaming bot. Desperate to kill, the drone fired. Melting carbon caused the bullet to miss and ricochet into a box of cat litter. Lash took the opportunity to whack the machine with a broom handle. Billowing smoke inside, the cramped space made it hard to breathe. She slid open the lone window, leaped into the backyard again, and hauled, never looking back.
Oh my gosh, so visual. I was so in it.
Thank you.
That's awesome. I was totally seeing it like a movie. Just like yes, you yes. wanted.
And I wanted to make sure that we begin in medias res, you know, in the middle of the action and not with the character waking up in the morning and petting the cat and getting ready to start the day in the post-apocalypse. I wanted the story to to suck the reader in, and to, you gradually you learn about Lash and her desperate circumstances, and the fact that she's not exactly like your everyday dystopian warrior hero or heroine. She's someone who's got a specific mission in mind.
I love, though, also that you're already rooting for her. Like,
yes,
you're, like, and even the name Lash, like, it can have multiple meanings, like eyelashes, but also, like, you could lash somebody and cut
yes.
them. Love it. Thank you so much, Jarrett. It's been such a pleasure talking to you.
Oh, I love that. We should do this again. I hope we'll spend some time there looking at the books when I'm in the Tampa St. Pete area.
Yeah, please look me up. And, we have all kinds of events going on in the city. There's never a dull moment in the art community. Very different than how it was when you lived here. And
oh, yeah.
It's a wild, during COVID, it was like quiet. And right after the lockdown, we had 2 weeks, and it was like, I actually started tearing up because I went out driving and it reminded me of the early 90s. And I was like, oh my God, it's so busy now.
Yes.
Yeah. So different. I was like, I don't want that. I wanted to stay this quiet. It's wild though. But Jared, well, thank you so much.
Thank you. And tell everyone that I said hello. And I'm just excited to know that you're son is so in love with movies and really digging up pop culture.
Yeah, me too. He's a cool kid to parent. He's a cool kid to parent. So everyone, thank you so much for tuning into this episode of Typewriter Talks. If you want to know more about Keep St. Pete Lit, you can go to keepstpetelit.org. And if you like this programming, please consider donating to help support us to continue on with chatting with writers about their writing process. And again, thank you, Jarrett. And everyone, we will talk to you next week.
Typewriter Talks features interviews with writers, poets, and other bookish folks. It is hosted by Maureen McDole, founder and executive director of Keep St. Pete Lit, which is a literary arts organization based in St. Petersburg, Florida. Listen in to hear discussions on all kinds of writerly topics. Our goal is to show you that there is not one right way to be a writer. Learn more about Keep St. Pete Lit at www.keepstpetelit.org.